The following podcast was recorded at the Presbyterian Church in Burlington on July 26, 2015.
Well, after that, I suppose I ought to say good morning. We'll do the rest of the sermon in English, however. The story of the Tower of Babel is one of those great old stories of the Bible. Familiar stories like Noah and the Ark or Daniel in the Lion's Den that many of us learned as children, perhaps in Sunday school or vacation Bible school. A potential problem with these great old stories of the Bible is that they may be just too familiar. We're sometimes tempted to understand these stories as we originally learned them. Oh yeah, I remember that story from Mrs. Hansen's fifth grade Sunday school class. The meaning of that story is fill in the blank. Or worse yet, we may grow to think of these as children's stories and may not consider them relevant to our own adult lives at all. Where I grew up in western Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh, there were many descendants of Eastern European immigrants who had come to work in the coal mines and in the steel mills. And particularly in the city, there were many Eastern Orthodox churches with those beautiful onion domes. Now, I don't know if there is, in fact, any particular meaning or symbolism behind the onion domes, but an onion strikes me as a very good metaphor for these great old stories of the Bible. Because as we go back and revisit them, we find that, in fact, there are many layers of meaning beneath the surface. Each time we peel back one layer of meaning, we find another that we had not considered before. This morning, as we look at the story of the Tower of Babel, let's peel back the onion and consider some of these different levels of meaning. If we ask what's the meaning of this story, why has this story come down to us, the obvious first answer is that this was an explanation story. It answers the questions, why did humans speak so many different languages? One can imagine a wilderness oasis where the caravans of different peoples have stopped to spend the night, and around that campfire we were talking about, a little child asks, why do people speak so many different languages? And grandma answers, well, once upon a time, everybody spoke the same language. And she retells the story of the Tower of Babel. However, if we look at the context in which we find this story in the Hebrew Scriptures, it's clear that the folks who put our Bible together didn't really need any explanation for why people speak so many different languages. The Tower of Babel story is in chapter 11 of Genesis. Chapter 9 is the story of Noah and the Ark. Chapter 10, in between these, describes how the descendants of Noah spread out across the earth. And it gives a very naturalistic account of different tribes spreading out in different geographic regions and developing their own different cultures and languages. Listen to this description from chapter 10 of Genesis with some of the more boring bits of genealogy edited out. These are the descendants of Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The descendants of Japheth are Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, and Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. I didn't edit them all out. From these, the coastland peoples spread. These are the descendants of Japheth, in their lands, with their own language, by their families, in their nations. The descendants of Ham are Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. These are the descendants of Ham, by their families, their languages, their lands, and their nations. To Shem also children were born. The descendants of Shem are Elam, Ashur, Arpachshad, Lud, and Aram. These are the descendants of Shem, by their families, their languages, their lands, and their nations. These are the families of Noah's sons, according to their genealogies, in their nations, and from these the nations spread abroad on the earth after the flood. Listening to this description, it appears that the editors who put together the book of Genesis didn't need an explanation story to tell them why there were so many different languages. It was a natural outcome as the descendants of Noah spread out according to their genealogies in their lands by their families and in their nations with their own languages. Okay, so why is this story in the Bible? The most common interpretation is that this is a moral tale. As the children of Noah spread across the face of the earth, one contingent on the plain of Shinar, and that's more or less Babylonia, the delta between the Tigris and the Euphrates River, decide that they don't want to be scattered abroad. They're going to stay put, make a name for themselves, build a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. This tower is a symbol of their pride, power, and self-sufficiency. God disapproves of this and puts a stop to it by confusing their language so that they leave off their building and are scattered over the face of the earth. That's a reasonable interpretation of the story and the one that most of us grew up with. After all, pride is the original and one of the most serious on the list of seven deadly sins. And what does the book of Proverbs tell us about pride? Pride goeth before... Well, actually, it's pride goeth before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. But surely those folks on the plain of Shinar were both prideful and haughty. When our boys were growing up, two of the main sources of entertainment in the house were Bible storybooks and Animaniacs. One of the recurring gags on Animaniacs was the Wheel of Morality. Near the end of the episode, the Warner Brothers and Sister Dot would spin a wheel reminiscent of the Wheel of Fortune and chant, "Wheel of Morality, turn, 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 tell us the lesson that we must learn." The Wheel of Morality then offered up some absurd lesson, such as, if at first you don't succeed, blame it on your parents. Or, never ask what hot dogs are made of. Or, if you can't say something nice, then you're probably at the Ice Capades. One of the series of Bible storybooks that we owned had a similar feature to it. At the end of the book was a Dear Parents section for those who needed some help with biblical interpretation. And this section explained the meaning of the story. Although in my more charitable moments, I realized that the editors were simply trying to be helpful, I must say that I was always rather annoyed that the idea that a Bible story had just one meaning. So is there something more to the tower story beyond the moral that pride leads to destruction? Is there another layer to this onion? We'll come back to the idea of pride in a little bit, but one of the subplots of this story may be a theological warning about proper worship. Take a look at the building materials of this tower. "Come, let us make bricks and fire them well." They used bricks for stone and tar for mortar. These are not Hebrew building materials. If you look at the detailed description of the building of Solomon's temple, you find that those building materials were natural materials, wood and stone, not bricks and tar, or bitumen, as it is in some translations. Those are Mesopotamian building materials, and it's likely that that Tower of Babylon, described in the story, was in fact what we would refer to as a ziggurat. You've seen pictures of them, perhaps, those layered pyramids with a zigzag ramp leading up to the top, with a shrine or temple up there on the upper platform. These were religious structures that were built by the Babylonians and also the Sumerians, Akkadians, and Assyrian people who lived in Mesopotamia. And the idea seems to have been that being physically nearer to the heavens also brings you spiritually closer to God in the heavens. Now, the Canaanite people, whom the Hebrews displaced, and whose religious practices were always an ongoing threat to the proper worship of God, had a similar idea, and that's the so-called high places. These were hilltops on which altars and pillars were erected, and again, the idea seems to be that these high places might bring you nearer to God, or to the gods. The Hebrew scriptures take a uniformly dim view of these high places, as in this verse from the book of Numbers. "You shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, destroy all their figured stones, destroy all their cast images, and demolish all their high places." A message that the Hebrew listeners to this tower story may have heard was that those foreign religious practices were folly. The way to come close to God is not in religious shrines built on towers or on hilltops, but instead, the way that we come near to God, according to the Hebrews, is by following the law and the prophets. Rejecting over-the-top, over-ritualized religious practices, the prophet Micah tells us that what the Lord requires of us is to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with our God. Notice that instruction to walk humbly in contrast to grandstanding, supersized religious practices. But back to pride again. There are some problems with interpreting God's confusing these people's languages and scattering them across the earth as a way to prevent them from accomplishing great feats or as a punishment for their sin of pride. First off, and as James alluded to, we need to be very careful not to view God in this story as jealous and insecure. It's possible to draw that false impression when we hear God say, "One people, one language. Why, this is only the first step. No telling what they'll come up with next. They'll stop at nothing." There's one ironic detail in the story that makes it very clear that God was not afraid that these people would ever outdo God's works. They intended to build a tower that reached into heaven. But notice that when God wants to have a close look at this great marvel, God needs to go all the way down to earth to see it. The tower is just not all that grand on God's scale. Also, the idea that confusing their language and scattering these people is a form of punishment is difficult to accept when we look again at those previous two chapters of Genesis. After all, it was God's original plan to scatter, disperse, or spread abroad the descendants of Noah to fill the earth. We read in chapter 9 that God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." Shem, Ham, and Japheth were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was peopled. We heard in chapter 10 how they were to spread out into new lands, forming new nations, speaking their own languages. If this was God's original plan for the sons of Noah in chapter 9 and 10, it's a little bit difficult to see it as a punishment in chapter 11 for the tower builders. So what's going on here? What's the next layer of the onion? Pride can be one side of a two-sided coin. The other side of that coin is fear. Notice that the people built two things in this story. We always focus on the tower, but they also built a city, probably a walled city. The Hebrew word used here is the common one in Hebrew scriptures for a city, but it has the original sense of a place with a watchguard. The implication is that these tower builders were afraid of other folks out there on the plain of Shinar. And when a community or society or nation is fearful about its rivals, external or internal, It's not uncommon to engage in some monument building, a concrete expression of the unity, power, wealth, or technical achievements of that society. Consider the space race. In 1962, President Kennedy told the nation and the world that we chose to go to the moon within a decade, not because it was easy, but because it was difficult. And the goal would serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. That was good-sounding rhetoric. It had perhaps a bit of pride in it, but also, if we're honest, there was also a good measure of fear. The Soviet Union had been the first to launch an artificial satellite, Sputnik, into orbit around the Earth. The Soviets were the first to send a cosmonaut, Yuri Gagarin, into space. There was fear in the US that American know-how was being eclipsed by the Soviet Union, and that our culture, our society, and our form of government would be viewed by the rest of the world as second rate. This space race was something that we could unite behind to demonstrate our capabilities to the world. It was a way to conquer our fear. Unity, however, is another two-sided coin. We typically think of unity as a good thing. The Tower story opens with the words, "At one time, the whole earth spoke the same language." Those were presumably the good old days, the desired state that we long to get back to. Unity is encouraged, working together to accomplish common goals. We learn that at school, we learn that at work, we learn that in scouts, and even in church. The Apostle Paul tells us about being one body. So unity is good. But there's a dark side to unity as well. In his exposition of the Tower story, Bible scholar Walter Brueggemann reminds us that there is a different kind of unity sought by fearful humans organized against the purposes of God. This unity attempts to establish a cultural human oneness without any reference to God. This self-made unity has a fortress mentality, that walled city. It seeks to survive by its own resources. It seeks to construct a world free of the risks of the holy and immune to God's will. It's a unity that's grounded in fear and characterized by coercion. A human unity without the vision of God's will is likely to be ordered in oppressive conformity. And the Tower story tells us that this kind of unity will finally be in vain. Speaking one language. Think how we use phrases like that today. When a group or a society is challenged and fearful of opposition, we talk about reading from the same page, keeping on script, or singing off the same hymn sheet. One language can be a way to coerce others and squash dissent. Just recently, it's been reported that the Florida State Department of Environmental Protection has ordered its employees not to use the terms climate change or global warming in any official communications, emails, or reports. That's one form of unity, one way of speaking a single language. It may stem from pride, but it also comes from fear. Fear of diversity of opinion. In verse 7 of the Tower story, it says that they won't be able to understand each other. And that's the conventional and probably original translation of the verb shema, to understand. But Brueggemann points out that shema can mean both to understand or to listen. So verse 7 could be translated that they were unable to listen to each other. The inability to listen to each other is the symptom of a closed and fearful society. Brueggemann argues that the capacity to listen to each other depends on trust in the speaker, willingness to be changed, and willingness to have newness come into one's life. Such open speaking and open listening is the intended mode of conversation in the Bible. In this context, the tower story can be understood not as a story of God's punishment of a society deluded by its arrogance and self-sufficiency, but rather as a story of God restoring and accomplishing an original plan for movement, diversity, and growth, despite the resistance of a fearful society that tried to hunker down and speak just one language. Well, by now you may have become bored with the sermon and are wondering about that photo and bulletin cover. What you see on the right, and as Bob Timmerman identified, is a TV tower. It's the iconic East Berlin television tower. It's the tallest man-made structure in Germany. It was built between 1965 and 69 at the peak of the Cold War. It was meant not to just function as a TV tower, but to be a symbol visible everywhere throughout both East and West Berlin that affirmed the cultural, economic, and technical power of the communist regime. You might say they wanted to make a name for themselves. You might also remember that they built themselves a walled city. You might say building that tower was an act of pride, but you might also say it was an act of fear. After the tower was completed, quite unintentionally and much to the embarrassment of the communists, it was found that sunlight reflecting off that stainless steel disco ball affair that's at the top of the tower created the image of a cross. If you look carefully at that photo, you can see that cross. The East Germans tried various coatings and surface treatments to eliminate the cross effect, but it would not go away. It's particularly ironic that although the East German government was not quite able and strong enough to completely ban the church, they did require crosses to be removed from church buildings throughout East Berlin. The locals refer to the cross image on the TV tower as the Pope's revenge. Like the Tower of Babel, the Berlin TV tower serves as a reminder that God's purpose will be worked out despite the resistance of fearful societies that may retreat into the false security of one language. You know, we may not be all that different from those folks on the plain of Shinar. We may not want to do something different. We may not want to do something new. We may be afraid to go to some new place where we're not completely comfortable. We may not want to listen to the folks who tell us that we ought to follow God and go there. But the tower story tells us that if it is God's plan, then that is where we must finally go. Amen.
Amen.
Our hymn is...
Today's sermon was delivered by guest speaker Mark Vogel. This podcast was produced by the Presbyterian Church in Burlington, 335 Cambridge Street, Burlington, Mass., and edited by James McNinch. If you can't visit us in person, then visit our website at www.burlingtonpres.org. This podcast is copyright 2015 and provided under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. That means you have permission to download and give away copies of this podcast.